Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In the throes of a severe and immediate health crisis, would you get the best, most up-to-date treatment? The answer might depend less on where you go than on who you are. Numerous studies published in the American Journal of Public Health and elsewhere suggest the healthcare system does not work as well for people of color as it does for those with white skin, even when care providers do not mean to be racist. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest estimates that more than 80,000 black and brown lives could be saved every year if they receive treatment equivalent to their white peers. And she says the way to make it happen is to effectively outlaw acting on unconscious bias in healthcare settings. Dana Bowen-Matthew is professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. Her new book is called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. Dana, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
We should start by saying there are just a huge number of studies that demonstrate a racial bias in healthcare. Can you give us a sense of the kinds of problems that they've revealed?
Sure. I categorized them into six different mechanisms or pathways that these studies show racial bias causes unequal treatment. So the first categories have to do with what happens even before a doctor and a patient get together in a clinical setting. The doctor has perceptions that come from radio, television, movies, experiences. They all get stored in his or her personal knowledge, and those perceptions may say that the person of color is not as smart, not as cooperative, not as friendly, not as likely to follow her instructions. Then there are two sets of differences that happen in the clinical setting itself. Now, the secret about this is that they work on both sides. Mm. Both the doctor and the patient might have some perceptions that are a result of implicit bias. Let me take the patient, for example. I may walk in, and because I've had so many discriminatory experiences, I look at the doctor's lower eye contact, the softer voice, the fewer questions that he or she asks me, and I assume that's racism, so I don't go back. That affects my outcome. And then finally, we have a lot of data that tells us that treatment decisions will sometimes be different. In fact, we have studies that show, one or two actually, studies that show when implicit biases are higher, the best treatment options are less likely to be offered to people of color.
How do you measure implicit bias?
Great question. There's a lot of ways that social scientists have used, but the most popular and most heavily validated test is called the implicit association test. And actually, Chris, any of us can take that test. We can go online and put in Project Implicit, and there's a computerized test that will test our implicit biases for any range of topics. So we've used the race implicit association test, I'll call it the IAT from now on, to measure how quickly someone will associate the picture of someone who is typically black and the words that are positive, good, pretty, kind, sweet. On the other hand, how quickly or slowly someone might associate negative words with a person who is photograph is phenotypically black, might also tell that those implicit associations are less easily made. So you see, the sum of the time period that it takes a person to make an association between a picture of a person of a certain race and words that are good or bad are added up to give an implicit association score, and that reflects implicit bias.
It is very disturbing when this happens between, let's say, a white healthcare provider and a patient of color. But it's not limited to white healthcare providers, this effect.
No, it isn't. And that's because implicit associations are the aggregate or the cumulative knowledge that all of us gather, whether we're black or white or Latino or Asian. We all live in the United States and hear the same music, hear the same political debates, read the same newspapers and books. All of this stores social knowledge in our unconscious minds and then gets triggered or retrieved when we meet a person of a certain race. We make those associations automatically based on our experiences and our environment. So if we share that environment, then a black doctor, a white doctor, an Asian doctor would also share the same social knowledge that informs implicit biases.
Dana, people have observed disparate healthcare outcomes by race just anecdotally for a long time. Other than biases within the healthcare system, which are being looked at these days, what other factors were cited in the past to account for these different outcomes?
If I understand you correctly, I think you're asking me what other settings do we know that implicit biases operate. The book that I've written brings that knowledge together in the medical setting, but as you've correctly noted, it's been around for years in other settings. So we have lots of information about implicit biases operating, for example, between police officers and victims. So we call that shooter bias. And in experiments or simulations, we have seen that a white police officer will react more quickly to shoot based on biases and assumptions for a figure that is of color than he or she will shoot for a figure that is a white person. We've seen implicit biases in employment context. We've seen implicit biases in jury selection. We've seen them in lots of different settings. This book collects those data for the medical setting.
That's great information. It's actually, I didn't state my question very well in the first place. What I was asking about was when people looked at different outcomes in the healthcare system by race before, they said, okay, you don't do as well if you happen to be a black patient than if you're a white patient. I was leading you to the idea that many people just blamed the patient, that they assumed that there was something that the patient was doing wrong and that somehow patients of color were more likely to do things wrong or have poor lifestyle choices, that sort of thing.
Sure. I understand your question better now. So there's no doubt that disparate outcomes have lots to do with a complex network of different factors. So for some of the differences, we look to clinical differences, that is, things that are actually biologically different between a patient of color and a patient who is white. That, however, accounts for a very small difference in the treatment differences that we're looking at in this book, so maybe 10%. We can also look at behavioral differences, the difference between diet, sedentary versus an active lifestyle, weight, family history. Again, this does account for some difference, but a smaller difference than one would assume. The social determinants of health, where somebody lives, works, plays, if I live in a dangerous neighborhood versus a safe neighborhood where I can easily exercise, these have an influence. This book, however, is about differences that are most untenable because they have to do neither with biological nor with clinical nor with any other physical difference, but only with the way that people are treated in the clinical encounter based on the color of their skin.
Do those biases tend to get worse over time? Do they self-perpetuate?
We don't know, but we do have some evidence that because these biases are based on cumulative knowledge, that they can self-perpetuate as you've described. The experiments that would have to show us that would be longitudinal, and we don't have those. When I say longitudinal, I mean over time. And I'm not aware that we have those to answer that question precisely.
Assuming that most people do not enter the helping professions with the intention of providing substandard care to non-white patients, we know it happens anyway. I'm curious, though, to know how healthcare professionals have responded to these studies really implicating implicit bias. Do people tend to recognize themselves as providing biased care?
So this is a great question on a number of levels. First, because as I interviewed physicians, scores of physicians during this writing this book, I found what you've described, and that is people do not enter the helping professions to be racist. These are not people who want to treat people of color differently. In fact, quite the opposite. I found more often that a physician that I interviewed, I'll use an example of an emergency physician who's one of the most outspoken advocates for patients of color in her community. They very much want to treat people fairly, equally. They are egalitarians. This happens, implicit biases have an influence on care unbeknownst to and in contradiction to this type of physician's best intention. So again, with this emergency room physician, the story that she told me was about a Latino man that fell off of a ladder. And she immediately assumed that he was uninsured. Hmm. She immediately assumed that she could not give him the treatment of choice. Now, this was not based on evidence. This was based on an association, a stereotype that she no more wanted to make than, I'll say, the man on the moon. So one of the things we find out about implicit biases and that I saw in the reactions, to answer your question directly, is that people are surprised. But there's good news in that surprise, because the study that I most often quote was by Alexander Green, in which he revealed to his physician subjects the same surprise, the surprise that this was a study about racism, about their racism. And Chris, do you know that just that revelation made a difference in the level of implicit bias and how much it influenced bias treatment? People can change, and people want to change. They want to do right.
My guest is Dana Bowen Matthews. She's professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. Her new book is called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Dana Bowen Matthew.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dana Bowen Matthew, professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. Her new book is called Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. Dana, you assert that the law has directly influenced the differences in healthcare available today to whites versus racial and ethnic minority groups in the U.S. How does our history of laws that supported at one time slavery, segregation, immigrant exclusion, how does that relate to what happens within the healthcare system in the 21st century?
The history actually sets the tone for the fact that law is a mechanism to set social norms. One of the things that we see throughout history is that when the law made it normal to mistreat American Indians or to mistreat Chinese immigrants, their health suffered because the culture accepted mistreatment. Fast forward to the 21st century, and what you see is that our current anti-discrimination law makes it illegal and unacceptable as a social norm to be explicitly bigoted or prejudiced. And as a result, when you look at surveys, most people in America decry racism and decry outright bigotry. Our law, however, does not prohibit unconscious bias. It does not prohibit the same harms that came from explicit prejudice and segregation now being visited upon people of color as a result of unconscious racism. And so the social norm accepts this unconscious racism, and the outcome is deadly.
So how do you set up a civil rights law that targets unconscious racism? Do you have to look at outcomes and then sort of extrapolate from there?
No, actually, it's amazingly easy. As with so much of the research that is gathered in my book, many people before me have thought of these. I just have done the work of putting it together. So what would be necessary are three pretty straightforward changes in the Civil Rights Act, known as Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. First of all, number one, we would have to acknowledge that disparate impact, that is the type of indirect violation that is not intentional, is actually prohibited in law. Secondly, we'd have to set the standard at what is known as reasonableness. That is to say that people have to take reasonable steps to prohibit unconscious racism or implicit bias. That would be hospitals have to take what is, by the scientific evidence, reasonable to do to stop their physicians from using these unintentional biases. And the third change that I would like to see made in that law is to recreate the availability of a private cause of action. That is, that if all else fails, and that the incentives that providers and clinicians are being invited to take to prohibit unconscious bias, if all else fails, then private parties who are victims of unconscious bias could bring a lawsuit.
Let's talk about some of the ways you can reasonably prevent unconscious bias. One of them is as simple or complicated as pointing out to healthcare professionals the existence of something like implicit bias.
Sure, sure. And again, a lot of what I'm asking for is evidence-based. So you've heard of evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. What I'm hoping to see is evidence-based lawmaking, which will encourage evidence-based behavior. So a provider, a hospital, for example, if you think of what happened after HIPAA became the law, the privacy law, became a required reading for all hospital providers and clinicians. Along came many HIPAA programs that doctors had to take on video, had to sign and represent that they were familiar with. Had to keep current with. There were officers or offices appointed in hospitals to monitor and to encourage and to train. This is what happens when law sets a different social norm. I'd like to see the same thing happen with respect to unconscious bias and the discrimination that it causes and visits upon people of color.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Valerie in Wichita Falls. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. Yes, ma'am. I'm so sorry. I wanted to address about institutionalized racism. And I think she touched on that in your first question when you came back, how institutionalized racism plays a part in this clinical explicit bias, I believe she calls that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Valerie. Okay.
I think I can guess where Valerie is going with this, and I appreciate her question a lot, because a lot of the pressure to correct unconscious bias may appear to be aimed just on the individual physician. That's not my intention. That's not my hope. Institutions are responsible for setting the tone, and that's why the law is such an important change agent here. I'd like the law to change the institutional incentives. Once the law is changed, a hospital will change its training programs, its hiring practices, its risk profile. It will change the way patient forms are set, patient policies are set, and the institution will correct, not just burden the individual provider with making the corrections that I'm calling for.
Can you relate access to healthcare services to racial bias, even if you account for, say, income disparities?
Yes, if I understand your question, let me invite you to correct me if you think I've missed your question. So access to a low-quality product is not access at all. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I worry about is how sincerely we have spent a lot of money, a lot of research, a lot of time in this country trying to get access to healthcare for people of color. That's an important piece of the disparities puzzle. It's an important solution. But if the access is to an inferior or discriminatory health system, then that access will not eradicate disparities. What I'd like to see is that access is equalized to a treatment that is equally high quality for Blacks, whites, Latinos, and others as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Marcy in Duncanville. Hey, Marcy.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to build on something that was said earlier before the break. I completed my dissertation looking at African-American men and their perspectives on their primary care providers, and then correlating that to how providers looked at African-American men, and they were not the providers of the men who actually were receiving the care. And interesting enough, the men identified things such as communication and respect as important, and indeed it was not necessary for them to have an African-American doctor, but one that recognized that they brought strength to the encounter and not capitalize on their deficits. On the other side of that, the providers were more looked more at the fact that they were not compliant and there were so many things that prevented them from really providing care. And so, you know, if providers can see that the expectation is not that you necessarily cure me, but you see me as an individual coming to you for help, then the chances are for the men who identified this, they were more compliant with their treatment regime and more forgiving of their provider of some shortcomings than the individuals where providers did not recognize that.
Marcy, thanks so much for your call. A lot of great information there. It sounds like your dissertation is fascinating. Is there anything that you want to go back and comment on, Dana?
There's so much in Marcy's dissertation. One of the things that I would like to highlight is the difference between what a patient will do when a patient perceives he or she is respected. Her dissertation was about men, but all patients in my inquiry showed the same kind of response. And the difference between that and what patients will do when they perceive discrimination. Marcy also pointed out that discrimination might be unintentionally communicated. And I saw that as well, both in the quantitative data from studies and in interviews. So one woman told me that the fact that her physician didn't make eye contact, cut the interview short, did not answer her questions, asked her fewer questions, and gave her less information was a reason that she decided not to come back. And it sounds like Marcy's dissertation shows something similar. A patient can pick up unconscious discrimination and hurt their own chances for recovery, hurt their own chances for equal outcomes by saying, I just don't want to experience that again. I'm not going back. That's a break in their continuity of care. One more thing that Marcy pointed out that I do want to pick up on, and that is, I think if I heard her correctly, she said that it didn't matter whether the provider was black or white, but if that provider communicated respect to the individual man that was being treated, then that patient felt that they could, they found a high level of satisfaction, let's say, with that encounter. That points out something interesting from the implicit bias literature, and that is both black, white, and Latino providers show similar anti-black, anti-Latino, and pro-white implicit biases and can communicate the same type of unconscious racism, no matter what color the provider is.
What does respect look like between a doctor and a patient? And is there any difference in the way that respect would manifest itself and be recognized by people within different communities?
Well, I'm sure that that's a very, the answer to that is yes, and that's a very complicated set of data and research. I only have a little bit of insight into what respect looks like. I do have insight into what the differences in communication look like. As I said earlier, eye contact is really important. Body language is important. So the differences that, for example, one medical student told me in observing her attending physicians in interacting with Latino patients versus white patients. With Latino patients, closed body, arms crossed, legs crossed, bodies not facing directly to the patient. With white patients, a more open stance, open arms, and welcoming language. This may or may not be interpreted necessarily as respect. I think more studies would have to support that. But certainly there's a difference, and the patients reacted to that difference.
We're speaking this hour with Dana Bowen Matthew, professor of law at the Colorado School of Public Health and the University of Colorado Law School. Her new book is Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. We will take more of your calls after the break at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dana Bowen-Matthew, professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. We're discussing her book, Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Dana, what kind of continuing education might bring the problem of implicit bias to light for healthcare workers?
This is a question that is also evidence-based. There are, about 25 years' worth of literature as to what works to reverse implicit bias. Some of the things that work the best are called stereotype negation training courses. If you think about implicit bias as a bad habit, something that you have developed over time, I'm going to use driving too fast as an example because it's one that's near and dear to my heart. I drove too fast for a very, very long time. In order to reverse that habit, I went to classes over a period of about three different weekends, not just one 2 or 3 hour session. I journaled. I spoke to people who were victims. I spoke to people who were going to prosecute me if I continued this. I did introspection. In other words, I began to reverse the connections that I had made between driving fast and getting where I wanted to go, and got new connections in my mind. So stereotype negation does the same thing with implicit biases, and we have several experiments that show that that works. Another thing that works, and the reason I choose law as one of the pieces to the puzzle of what the solution should look like, is changing the norms around actors. So some of the experiments that are most interesting to me are those that involve college students who were told that their racism was, in the one hand or in one group, the norm in their college. Most people agreed with them. And a group that was told that their racism was not the norm. Mm. Well, those groups behaved differently when they found out that they were either in or out of the consensus of the peers. So just changing what the norms are around, and that can be done institutionally, makes a difference. Thirdly, one of the things that really does change in implicit bias is counter stereotypes, showing different people of different races in places of authority, in places of decision making, and having those contacts and encounters be part of the daily experience of other providers and clinicians. So there are lots of data about what we call malleability. That's the social science word for we can do something about this, and there are steps that can reasonably be taken to reverse this habit.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Jonathan in Dallas. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, yes. Because of the organization I work for, I had really extensive training in diversity with Dr. C.T. Vivian and other people. And the takeaway for a white guy, this is a while ago, but was acknowledging I'm a racist because I was raised in a racist society. And I could talk a lot about this, but one thing I wanted to point out was I met people from, like, say, Ghana, and their perceptions of particularly black males in America came from television. And that's how they were actually kind of just as afraid of black men as, you know, your average white American. And I just found that really interesting. But I'm sure your guests are aware of so many studies that have been done where people are disadvantaged. There's not enough chairs. They don't have a pencil. Different things where the reaction that people have when, you know, they're just sort of cut out and disadvantaged. Anyway, thank you. Bye.
Thanks for your call.
So if I may, Chris, I want to react to a couple of things that your caller said. And mm-hmm. and the first one was I thought I heard it in the way of a little bit of a painful reaction. The takeaway for him was I have to acknowledge I'm a racist. And I hope that I can make clear that there is a difference between being a racist, somebody who intentionally makes a judgment that's negative about someone else because of their race. That's a racist. And someone who is acting out of implicit biases, even if we call it unconscious racism, which is fair to call it, I believe. That is not a racist. That is a person who is acting unintentionally and often in contradiction to their non-racist preferences. So I want to be clear that I'm not calling doctors racist or hospitals racist or even the healthcare system racist. I'm saying that the outcomes are racist and that we can't tolerate them anymore. May I use cancer as an example of why this is so important, not to get hung up on what is or is not politically correct, but really pay attention to the fact that people are dying and living sicker. We have to do something about this. So very quickly, let me just point out that the cancer research tells us that people of color are more likely to die by 33% for most major organ cancers. That's lung cancer, colorectal cancer, large cancers. And we all know someone, unfortunately, who has been stricken with these terrible cancers. Well, here's the problem with the difference in that number. If it was that the survival rates were less because there is a clinical difference, then we could tolerate that. But we know instead that people of color are diagnosed later. They don't get to the doctor. Once they're diagnosed, the treatment they get is less intensive. That makes their survival rate shorter. Even when they get the same intensity of treatment, they get less education. So they get less information, for example. They are less likely to be told about the possibility of a transplant. And therefore, they end up on transplant lists less frequently. Well, when you combine and aggregate all of these differences in treatment that have nothing to do with the clinical differences, you combine them and you remove them, Chris, what happens is that the survival rates equalize. So we can say that people would die less frequently from cancer if they were treated like whites. That's morally untenable, and that's something we must do something about. And we shouldn't get hung up on whether we're racist or not. We're not. We don't have to be racist. We have to fix this problem.
This is only, to an extent, an economic issue, but can you talk about even something like cost savings that might be associated with eliminating implicit bias within the healthcare system?
Sure. Just as David Satcher, who is the 16th Surgeon General of the United States, came up with the data that allows us to see the numbers of people who are dying needlessly from disparities. Dr. Tom Leviest from Johns Hopkins has come up with data that tells us how expensive these inequalities are. And his numbers are startling. In the billions of dollars over the course of 7 years, $224 billion for unnecessary deaths attributable to direct medical costs. And I think I've got that number right. Attributable to direct medical costs that are wasted because of these inequalities in healthcare treatment. And that doesn't even begin to approach the indirect costs of this unnecessary loss of life.
Do the new healthcare laws, the Affordable Care Act, do they make significant progress in trying to address bias in the healthcare system?
I think they do. They go a certain distance. There are some 60-odd provisions in the Affordable Care Act that are intended to address disparities, that reiterate the importance of Title VI, that make the elimination of disparities important, that provide funding for research into health disparities. And those are very important insofar as they go. The next step that is needed, however, is a change in the laws that particularly address the discrimination that results or in these disparities, that causes these disparities. So it's one thing to document that they exist. It's another thing to document that they are a problem. It's yet another thing to actually change the discrimination law so that these problems can be addressed.
Dana Bowen-Mathieu is professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. Her new book is Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. Dana, thank you very much for spending this time with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.